readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. To quote the beloved Robert Frost, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Today's show puts the literary spotlight in fiction and nonfiction on those who've taken the road less traveled. Paths with twists and turns, journeys both memorable and seriously quirky. Like the cross-country jaunt of my guest today, John Waters. Yes, he of Pink Flamingos fame. Mr. Waters was not content to go coast to coast on a 747. Nope, he definitely took the road less traveled. He hitchhiked across our great land. The stories he collected are hilarious, surprisingly warm, and wonderful. So let's get our trip started as we turn to page one of the book report. Best-selling novelist and American icon Tom Robbins serves up Tibetan Peach Pie, a true account of an imaginative life, the long-awaited tale of his wild life and times, both at home and around the world. Tom Robbins' wise and weird novels, including Still Life with Woodpecker and Jitterbug Perfume, have provided an entryway into the frontier of his singular imagination. Madcap but pulsating with strong social and philosophical undercurrents, his irreverent classics have introduced countless fans to hitchhiking cowgirls, born-again monkeys, exiled royalty, and problematic redheads. In Tibetan Peach Pie, Robbins stitches together stories of his unconventional life, from his Appalachian childhood to his globe-trotting adventures. The grandchild of Baptist preachers, Robbins would become, over the course of half a century, a poet interruptus, an Air Force weatherman, a radio DJ, an art critic turned psychedelic journeyman, a famous novelist, and a counterculture hero, all the while leading a life as unlikely and bizarre as his memorable characters. Keith Zarabashka narrates.
I attended a large consolidated school, grades 1 through 12 in the same three-story building. There was a bi-weekly school newspaper, edited and almost exclusively written by juniors and seniors. Well, I had recently composed on notebook paper, a snow-white scrapbook having long since been filled, a rather melodramatic story featuring a reckless boy, a courageous dog, and a dangerous waterfall. So one day during recess, I trudged up to the third-floor newspaper office, slapped the story down on the surprised editor's desk, and said, "Print this." It appeared in the next issue, and I thought, that was easy. Maybe I could do this for a living. Flushed, perhaps, by having become a literary lion in the second grade, I proposed marriage. As evidence of my sincerity, I gave my intended a ring, a kitschy little costume trinket with a wobbly glass stone. The ring had cost me 25 cents, and lest anyone think me cheap, please consider that in 1939, a quarter could buy 2 hamburgers and a hot dog with mustard, onions, and relish at Bynum's Cafe, not to mention 5 new sunsuits from Tommy Rotten. Was it Nancy Lentz to whom I proposed, or was it her cousin Tony? I can't remember which. They were both beauties, nor do I recall if she did more than giggle incomprehensibly at my matrimonial gesture. I do remember that it was Gwendolyn Berryman with whom that same year I played one-on-one post office. A letter was a kiss, a package an embrace, in the front seat of the Berryman sedan, parked in our driveway, while oblivious, our moms chatted away in the living room. What was the source, one might ask, of such overtly romantic impulses in a boy so young? We could do worse than lean on Bob Dylan. Because the answer is indeed blowing in the wind. Blowing. Blowing rock. Having spent significant and affecting years in each of them, I claim to have 5 hometowns, and never mind that not one of them would likely lay claim to me. Listed in reverse order, they are Laconia and Seattle in Washington State, Richmond and Warsaw in Virginia, and Blowing Rock, North Carolina, the town where I was born, the final resting place of my kin, and the site of all the events so far described in this account. It's a bit of an understatement to say that Blowing Rock is in the mountains. The highest incorporated town east of the Rockies, Blowing Rock is on the mountains, atop the mountains. From Blowing Rock, baby, it's all downhill. The town took its name from a geological formation, an actual rock, an immense cliff of metamorphic gneiss, a jutting promontory that protrudes like God's sore thumb out over the Johns River Gorge, more than 3,000 feet below. It's possible to rather easily climb out onto the rock and marvel there at a panoramic view any postcard would die for, though the perch is not for the vertiginous. Okay, but why Blowing? The rocky walls of the gorge form a flume through which silent winds sweep with considerable force, although atop the rock itself it's usually calm. A visitor can toss a handkerchief, a paper cup, or any light object off of the cliff, watch it go spiraling hundreds of feet down, down, down into the purplish mist far below, until a mysterious current suddenly seizes it, lifts it up, 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 and blows it back over the head of the tosser, who may then turn, retreat a few yards, and retrieve that which he or she has tossed, hopefully not his or her cookies. In winter at the rock, the snow falls upside down. It's unthinkable that a natural phenomenon of this order, as mystifying as it is spectacular, would not generate local myth. In recent years, the mythology surrounding the rock has taken on complex cinematic properties, as if rewritten by a Chamber of Commerce booster with a made-for-TV sensibility. But the simpler and somehow sweeter legend I heard as a child went like this. A Cherokee maiden has received word via the Tom-Tom Telegraph that her lover and husband-to-be has been killed in battle. Inconsolable, the distraught girl goes to the rock and hurls herself, wailing into the abyss.
That was Tibetan Peach Pie by Tom Robbins. Growing up in Baltimore in the 1950s, John Waters was not quite like the other kids. He was obsessed by violence and gore, both real and on the screen. With his weird counterculture friends as his cast, he began making silent 8 and 16 millimeter films in the mid-1960s. He screened these in rented Baltimore church halls to underground audiences drawn by word of mouth. As his filmmaking developed and his subject matters more shocking, his audiences grew bigger. By the early 1970s, John was making features, which were shown in midnight screenings in art cinemas. Major success came in 1972 with Pink Flamingos, a deliberate exercise in ultra-bad taste. Waters continued to make low-budget, shocking movies with his Dreamland Repertory Company until Hollywood crossover success came with Hairspray in 1988. Waters fans also know that John is an author. Today we'll speak with him about his new bestseller, Carsick. Welcome, John. It's a pleasure to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Thank you. Good to be here. You know, book reports, though, are why I didn't read till I was 16, because they made me read the most boring books, and to read was torture because I knew I had to do a report on it. Book reports discourage reading.
Okay, but we at the Book Report encourage reading.
I agree. That's what book reports should be. Adults, people talking about books because they want to, not because they had to.
Gotcha. Okay, answer this question for me. It is one you posed in the beginning of the book. Is it possible to be a vagrant when you can own 3 homes and rent another in P-Town for the summer?
No. Basically, I was like the book Black Like Me, only was poor like me. I was a faux vagrant. However, yes, because technically I had a credit card in my pocketbook that I could have called a helicopter to come get me if I really wanted to. But I didn't have a follow-up. I almost had to spend the night in the woods one night. Just having a credit card, I didn't use it to do anything like that. I paid for somebody's gas. It didn't have any gas. I stayed in cheap motel, whatever was available on the way. So yes, I wasn't truly homeless. And it really drove home that point when other poor people would see me hitchhiking and had no idea who I was or anything, thought I was a poor 68-year-old, 60, I was 66 at the time, 66-year-old man hitchhiking, would come over to try to give me money, and one woman wouldn't leave till I took it. And I could see she seemed like a poor woman with a couple kids in her car, like driving somewhere along. So that was very moving to me, and I gave the money away. I didn't, like, pocket it, thanks. But still, it did make me understand, certainly. I would see people that you thought, my God, I'm just so lucky. You know, why didn't I give her $500, actually?
Early on in the book, in the actual retelling of your travels, you ended up in the back of a cop car. You want to share that story?
Well, in the first part of the book that is fictional, that I imagine the best and the worst, I am in the back seat of a police car when I'm entrapped in Kansas and arrested for sodomy, where technically that is still illegal for hetero, homosexual, any kind of couple. But in real life, I did get a ride with a cop. And the first cop came by and said, you can't hitchhike here. And I said, well, the other cop said I couldn't. It was the end of his shift, so he just let me go. The next day, I was stuck there for a whole day. So the cop saw me a lot standing there. Finally, he pulled over and then checked to see if I had warrants. And then I said, no, but I have a fame kit here I want to show you, which I had, which my assistant made. That it was so ridiculous. I had my Academy card. Like, I vote for the Oscars. Like, that's going to get me out of jail, right? And a clipping about hairspray or anything. So he looked through the whole thing real seriously, didn't say anything, and finally said, doesn't say you're a professional hitchhiker, which I thought was pretty funny. And I said, well, that means you can give me a ride. He said, okay, I will. Oh. And he was great. He gave me a ride as far as he legally could in his area. And then he said, I'll come check on you later. And I didn't get a ride. I was there for like 6 hours. And then he came back and gave me grief. He said, shake your sign or something. Like, I was a lazy hitchhiker. But he was very, very nice.
What percentage of folks who actually picked you up recognized you?
I would say only one of 12 of 21 rides, the very first ride, because it was right near my house. But many recognized me and drove past and debated, is that me? And then came back and picked me up. Maybe a third. The next third didn't know until I got in the car, or tried to give me money and then realized it was me and started yelling and laughing. And the other third, if I said I was not even me, they didn't know who me was, but if they said I was a film director or anything, they just acted like I said I was President Kennedy. You know, like I was a deluded homeless man off his meds. So I tried not, I just said okay when I realized that. I just, you know, I wanted to hear their story. I have to give interviews about myself every day. It's the last thing I want to do when I'm writing a book. I know my story. I wanted to hear theirs. The only reason you tell them your story is to get so they tell you stuff.
How did you dream up this adventure?
I just needed some street cred. My life is very organized, planned. I just wanted to give up that control and see what would happen. And I always hitchhiked. I hitchhiked when I was a kid. My parents thought it was fine. It wasn't thought of as bad. I don't know why. Same perverts were out there then. Same serial killers. They just, maybe you didn't know about them, or there weren't movies about them. I think the Texas Chainsaw Massacre hitchhiker made no one ever hitchhike again. And then I hitchhiked in the hippie years all the time. Everybody did. And then I hitchhiked as an adult in a province town to the beach I wanted to go to because I didn't have a sticker to park there. And that was as an adult. And then I started asking people to go on hitchhiking dates with me because it was a 10-mile trip. It wasn't. And it was fun. And then that, and I always liked hitchhiking. So then I decided to do the book. And it seemed like a great idea until the day I walked out the door to do it. And then I thought, are you nuts? You know, especially it started pouring rain. And then I would wake up in those days in some motel, and the first thing, wake up and think, you're really doing this? You know, I'm a third of the way there and think, oh, I'd look at the map and think, it's so far, you know. And so there were days that are very hard to remember now because I know I made it. I know it turned out fine. But you don't know that when you're in the middle of it and you're standing there for 8 hours, 10 hours, and you don't have a ride. You think, this could take a year.
Wasn't one of your hitchhiking dates with Patty Hearst?
I did hitchhike with Patty Hearst. She was funny about it. Her husband gave me so much grief about it afterwards. He said, haven't we had enough trouble? I said, yeah, but I haven't.
Some clarification. Have you met or ever driven with Connie Francis?
No, I haven't. I have met Connie Francis.
We're speaking with John Waters on The Book Report.
So pirate truck stops, they don't actually exist?
They do actually exist. They don't have them on the major interstates anymore. The truck stops there are so no fun. They're so regulated. All the trucker picked me up, and he said, it's no fun anymore. You have to have two drivers, so one sleeps and the other one, so you're never going to get a ride with a truck anymore. They all have chips in them, so they know exactly where they are. They only allowed to work so many hours a day. It's like a computers are in there and stuff. It's fancy in those trucks now. The real ones are in the south a lot. They're off the major road, and they're not quite as wild as the one I imagined, but from what I've heard, close.
All right. Tell us about the Corvette kid, and do you still keep in touch with him?
Yeah, he's the Corvette man now. I think he's an adult. The Corvette kid was a 19-year-old or 20-year-old elected Republican official in Millersville, Maryland, and he was on the way to get his lunch at the Subway shop, and it was pouring rain, and he picked me up. He didn't know who I was, even when I told him, never heard any of the movies. And we just kept talking, and he drove me to Ohio. And his parents were completely freaked out. That's like 4 hours. You know, he was missing. And then he said he was with me. And when your parents Google me, it isn't good. You know, they look up, say, friends of the Manson family, because I'm still trying to help Leslie Van Houten get parole that I wrote about in my last book. But still, they don't know any of that. They say, oh, great. And that I made the most disgusting movie ever made, Pink Flamingos. I just received some Best Gay Man of the Year award. You know, everything that would make a parent of a Republican elected official balk. And but he dropped me off in Ohio and went home, and I'm sure they gave him grief. So then I'm driving, I'm getting stuck in Ohio. I'm going, it's like days later, and he keeps texting me saying, I'm become gay. And I think, sure, sure, sure. So finally, I get this ride in Kansas, a really good ride. It's really long, like, you know, all the way to Denver, pretty much. So he's saying, I've told him that. And he said, you're kidding. I'm driving 48 hours at 80 miles an hour to catch up with you.
Aww.
And he did. And then gave me a ride a lot of the way to the rest, you know. And then I just gave him keys to my apartment in San Francisco. And just go stay there till I get there. And he told his parents that. And they said, you're back there? And then they said, I love this line. His mother said it was a great movie line if they ever make the movie. She said he told her that he was with me again, and I had given him keys to my apartment. He was going to go there, but I wouldn't be there. And there was stunned silence. And then she said, say out loud on the speakerphone what you just told me so your father can hear this. So I hope he would never let me talk to her. So I tried to calm her. And I get why she was upset, but what an adventure he had. We're still friends. He came to my Christmas party. He looks great. He's got a new great girlfriend. He moved out. I think he gained confidence. I think he's doing great.
Still in government?
No, he didn't run again.
Mm. You're a days in kind of guy. Tell us why.
Well, I'm more of a Chateau Marmont kind of guy.
Of course, in this book, in the framework of the book, let me clarify, in the framework of the book.
In Route 70, all the way across, I stayed in a mall, and I would say Days Inn was consistently the best, and Holiday Inn was the worst. The only time I had a mean person was in a Holiday Inn, and she told me if I flashed the sign one more time to a guest, my hitchhiking sign, she would call the police. And I said, well, that man, I was just waiting. He looked like the type that would pick me up. She said, that was my husband.
All right. We all hitchhiked in college and high school, but...
You'd be surprised.
Anybody over 50 has hitchhiked and would never do it again. All young people have never hitchhiked and want to, but are scared to.
But would you advise your younger friends to head to a highway on-ramp and stick out their thumbs?
Yes. I would do a trainer wheels short-term, hitchhikes to the store, hitchhike to the movies, hitchhike 10 miles away to something. Always use a sign. But yes, I think that I'm for everyone having an adventure. I think the most unsafe thing you can do is stay home.
Let's talk about your home for a minute. Baltimore, how has the city evolved in the last couple of years, and what do you think of its future?
I think it's the best it's ever been because, A, it's the only cheap city left on the East Coast. You can still have Bohemia there. All the kids from New York are moving there. We have a great music scene, Future Islands, Beach House, all the Dan Deacon, big nationwide hits. They all stayed in Baltimore. They all bought houses there. I think it is the last place you can be a bohemian.
And final thoughts about Carsick?
Well, my final thoughts, I'm thrilled it was on the New York Times bestseller list for 7 weeks. You know, things have changed. That's possible even is amazing and very, very gratifying to me. And all my books are still in print. Shock Value came out in 1980. It's never gone out of print. Crackpot, all of them. So it's obviously a world I like very much because they seem to like me. You know, my last movie was not a success financially. So I guess you stick in the field where you're doing the best.
Well, your book was laugh out loud funny, and I want to thank you so much for stopping by today.
Thank you. It's good. I like your new set here.
Find a sampling of Carsick at bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of July 12th, 2014. From Richard Flanagan, winner of Australia's National Fiction Prize, comes The Narrow Road to the Deep North, an epic novel of love and war that traces the path of one man from World War II to the present. In the despair of a Japanese POW camp on the Thailand-Burma Death Railway in 1943, Australian surgeon Dorigo Evans is haunted by his love affair with his uncle's young wife 2 years earlier. His life is a daily struggle to save the men under his command from starvation, cholera, and pitiless beatings. Then he receives a letter that will change him forever. Moving from the POW camp to contemporary Australia, from Dorigo's experiences, those of his comrades, to those of his Japanese guards, this tale explores the forms of good and evil, war and truth, guilt and transcendence, as one man comes of age and prospers, only to discover all that he has lost. David Atlas narrates.
The story behind this book begins on 15 February 1942. When one empire ends with the fall of Singapore and another arises. Yet by 1943, Japan, overstretched, under-resourced, is losing, and its need for this railway becomes pronounced. The Allies are supplying Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist army in China with armaments through Burma, and the Americans control the seas. To cut off this critical supply line to their Chinese enemy and to take India through Burma, as their leaders now madly dream, Japan must feed their Burmese forces with men and material by land. But it has neither the money nor machinery to build the necessary railway, nor the time. War, though, is its own logic. The Japanese Empire has a belief that it will win. The indomitable Japanese spirit, that spirit that the West does not have, that spirit it calls and understands as the Emperor's will, it is this spirit that it believes will prevail until its final victory. And, aiding such indomitable spirit, abetting such belief, the Empire has the good fortune of slaves. Hundreds of thousands of slaves, Asian and European, and among their number are 22,000 Australian POWs. Most surrendered at the fall of Singapore as a strategic necessity before the fighting has even properly begun. 9,000 of them will be sent to work on the railway. When, on 25 October 1943, steam locomotive C-5631 travels the length of the completed Death Railway, the first train to do so, towing its three carriages of Japanese and Thai dignitaries, it will be past endless beds of human bones that will include the remains of one in three of those Australians. Today, steam locomotive C-5631 is proudly displayed in the museum that forms part of Japan's unofficial National War Memorial, the Yasukuni Shrine in Tokyo. As well as steam locomotive C-5631, the shrine contains the Book of Souls. This lists over 2 million names of those who died in service to the Emperor of Japan in wars between 1867 and 1951. With enshrinement in the Book of Souls At this sacred site comes absolution from all acts of evil. Among those many names are those of 1,068 men convicted of war crimes after World War II and executed. And among those 1,068 names of executed war criminals are some who worked on the death railway and were found guilty of the mistreatment of POWs. On the plaque in front of locomotive C5631, there is no mention of this. Nor is there mention of the horror of the building of the railway. There are no names of the hundreds of thousands who died building that railway. But then, there is not even an agreed numbering of all those who died on the death railway. The Allied POWs were but a fraction, some 60,000 men of those who slaved on that pharaonic project. Alongside them were 250,000 Tamils, Chinese, Javanese, Malayans, Thais and Burmese. Or more. Some historians say 50,000 of these slave laborers died. Some say 100,000. Some say 200,000. No one knows.
We've just heard The Narrow Road to the Deep North by Richard Flanagan. Rise Again at a Decent Hour is a big, sharply observed novel about the absurdities of modern life and one man's search for meaning by National Book Award finalist Joshua Ferris. Paul O'Rourke is a Manhattan dentist with a thriving practice. He leads a quiet, routine-driven life. But behind the smiles in the nice apartment, he's a man of contradictions, and his biggest fear is that he may never truly come to understand anybody, including himself. Then, someone begins to impersonate Paul online, and he watches in horror as a website, a Facebook page, and a Twitter account are created in his name. What begins as an outrageous violation of his privacy soon becomes something more soul-frightening, the possibility that the online Paul might be a better version of the real thing. Campbell Scott performs the book.
I borrowed a lot to refurbish the new place. To pay back that money as quickly as possible, I went against the advice of the contractor, the objections of Mrs. Convoy, my own better instincts, and the general protocol of dentists everywhere, and ordered a floor plan without a private office. I installed a fifth chair in that space, and then spent the next 10 years killing myself, tending to five chairs in five rooms, and bitching about my lack of privacy, while raking in tons and tons of money. Everything was always something. It did no good to bitch about it. Some days I really held a grudge. I'd tell myself to get over myself. What could be better than a thriving practice and a management structure with me on top? My days weren't any longer than yours, except Thursdays. Some Thursdays we didn't get out of the office until 10 o'clock. I almost slept okay those nights, when the pills seemed almost redundant. First thing to go when you medicate to sleep are the dreams. Look on the bright side, I said to myself, as my dreams first started to fade. You're being spared, upon waking, the desperate need to convey to someone else the vivid images of a rich inner life. Everything was always something. But something, and here was the rub, could never be everything. A thriving practice couldn't be everything. A commitment to healthy patients and an afternoon mochaccino and pizza Fridays just couldn't be everything. The banjo couldn't be everything either, unfortunately. Streaming movies directly to the TV was almost everything when first available, but soon fell off to just barely something. The Red Sox had been everything for a long time, but they disappointed me in the end. The greatest disappointment of my adult life came in 2004, when the Red Sox stole the pennant from the Yankees and won the World Series. For 2 months one summer, I thought golf could be everything. For the rest of my life, I thought, I'll put all my energy into golf, all my spare time, all my passion, and that's what I did for 2 months, until I realized that I could put all my energy into golf, all my spare time, all my passion, for the rest of my life. I don't think I've ever been so depressed. The last ball I putted circled the hole, and the rimming impression it made as it dropped was that of my small life, draining into the abyss. So work, fun, and total dedication to something bigger than myself, something greater, my work, golf, the Red Sox, none could be everything, even if each, at times, filled the hour perfectly. I'm like that dreamer desperate to describe his dream when I try to explain the satisfactions of replacing a rotten tooth with a pontic so that a patient could smile again without shame. I had restored a baseline human dignity, no small thing. Pizza Fridays were no small thing. And that mochaccino was a little joy. The night in 2004 when David Ortiz homered against the Yankees to jumpstart the greatest comeback in sports history made me simply happy to be alive. I would have liked to believe in God. Now there was something that could have been everything better than anything else. By believing in God, I could succumb to ease and comfort and reassurance. Fearlessness was an option. Eternity was mine. It could all be mine. The awesome pitch of organ pipes, the musings of Anglican bishops. All I had to do was put away my doubts and believe. Whenever I was on the verge of that, I would call myself back from the brink. Keep clarity, I would cry. Hold on to yourself. For the reason the world was so pleasurable, and why I wanted to extend that pleasure through total submission to God, was my thinking, my reasoned, stubborn, skeptical thinking, which always, unfortunately, made quick work of God. Non servium, cried Lucifer. He didn't want to eat the faces off little babies. He just didn't want to serve. If he had served, he would have been just one more among the angels, indistinct, his name hard to recall even among the devout. I've tried reading the Bible. I never make it past all the talk about the firmament. The firmament is the thing on day one or two that divides the waters from the waters. Here you have the firmament. Next to the firmament, the waters. Stay with the waters long enough, presumably you hit another stretch of firmament. I can't say for sure. At the first mention of the firmament, I start bleeding tears of terminal boredom. I grow restless. I flick ahead. It appears to go like this. Firmament, super long middle part, Jesus.
We've just heard To Rise Again at a Decent Hour by Joshua Ferris. In his trio of critically acclaimed best-selling novels, The Sports Writer, The Pulitzer Prize-winning Independence Day, and The Lay of the Land, Richard Ford has illuminated the zeitgeist of an entire generation through his literary chronicler, Frank Bascom. Here, in Let Me Be Frank With You, Ford returns with four deftly linked stories narrated by the iconic Bascom. Now 68 and again ensconced in a New Jersey suburb, Bascom has seemed to thrive in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy's devastation. Indeed, the desolation of Sandy provides the perfect backdrop for Ford to address aging, race, loss, faith, marriage, redemption, the real estate crash, and the tumult of the world we live in. Richard Poe narrates.
The vacant-eyed, white-suited young Hess attendant who's pumping my gas hears nothing. He looks at me as if I wasn't here.
That about says it all, I guess, Mike concedes. In recent weeks, I've begun compiling a personal inventory of words that, in my view, should no longer be usable. In speech or any form. This, in the belief that life's a matter of gradual subtraction, aimed at a solider, more nearly perfect essence, after which all mentation goes and we head off to our own virtual Chillicothes. A reserve of fewer, better words could help, I think, by setting an example for clearer thinking. It's not so different from moving to Prague and not learning the language, so that the English you end up speaking to make yourself understood bears a special responsibility to be clear, simple, and value-bearing. When you grow old, as I am, you pretty much live in the accumulations of life anyway. Not that much is happening, except on the medical front. Better to strip things down. And where better to start stripping than the words we choose to express our increasingly rare, increasingly vagrant thoughts? It would be challenging, for instance, for a native Czech speaker to fully appreciate the words poop or friggin' or the phrase we're pregnant or what's the takeaway or, for that matter, awesome when it only means tolerable. or preemie, or mentee, or legacy, or no problem when you really mean you're welcome. Likewise, soft landing, sibs, bond. Hydrate, when it just means drink. Make art, share, reach out. Noise used as a verb. Language imitates the public riot, as the poet said. And what's today's life like, if not a riot? Yesterday, just past 8, an unexpected phone call disrupted my morning. My wife, Sally, answered, but got me out of bed to talk. I'd been lying awake in the early sunlight and shadows, daydreaming about the possibility that somewhere, somehow, some good thing was going on that would soon affect me and make me happy. Only I didn't know it yet. Since I took leave of the real estate business, after decades, anticipation of this kind is the thing I keenly miss. Though it's the only thing, given how realty matters have gone and all that's happened to me. I'm content here in Haddam, age 68, enjoying the next level of life. Conceivably the last. A member of the clean desk demographic. Free to do unalloyed good in the world, should I choose to. In that spirit, I travel once a week up to Newark Liberty with a veterans group to greet the weary, puzzled, returning troopers home cycling in from Afghanistan and Iraq. I don't truly credit this as a commitment or a true giving back, since it's hardly inconvenient to stand smiling, hand outstretched, loudly declaring, "Welcome home, soldier," or "sailor," or "airman. Thank you for your service." It's more grandstanding than serious, and mostly meant to demonstrate that we're still relevant, and thus is guaranteed to prove we're not. In any case, my personal sensors are on alert for more I can do that's positive with my end-of-days time, known otherwise as retirement. "Frank, it's Arnie Urquhart." A gruff, male, too-loud telephone voice crackled through distant, girdering automotive traffic noises. Somewhere in the background was music. Peter, Paul, and Mary singing "Lemon Tree" from Faraway 65. "Lemon tree very pretty, and the lemon flower is sweet."
We've just heard "Let Me Be Frank With You" by Richard Ford. Celeste Eng's haunting debut novel, Everything I Never Told You, has been featured on all of the best of lists for 2014. I think it's definitely worth a spot on today's book report. Lydia is dead, but they don't know this yet. So begins the story of a Chinese-American family living in small-town Ohio in the 1970s. Lydia is the favorite child of Marilyn and James Lee, a girl who inherited her mother's bright blue eyes and her father's jet-black hair. Her parents are determined that Lydia will fulfill the dreams they were unable to pursue. In Marilyn's case, that her daughter become a doctor rather than a homemaker. In James's case, that Lydia be popular at school, a girl with a busy social life and the center of every party. When Lydia's body is found in the local lake, the delicate balancing act that has kept the Lee family together tumbles into chaos, forcing them to confront the long-kept secrets that have been slowly pulling them apart. James, consumed by guilt, sets out on a reckless path that may destroy his marriage. Marilyn is determined to find a responsible party no matter what the cost. Lydia's older brother Nathan is certain the neighborhood bad boy Jack is somehow involved. But it's the youngest of the family, Hannah, who observes far more than anyone realizes, and who may be the only one who knows the truth about what happened. Cassandra Campbell narrates.
He and Hannah take after their father. Once a woman stopped the two of them in the grocery store and asked, "Chinese?" And when they said yes, not wanting to get into halves and wholes, she'd nodded sagely. "I knew it," she said, "by the eyes." She'd tugged the corner of each eye outward with a fingertip. But Lydia, defying genetics, somehow has her mother's blue eyes, and they know this is one more reason she is their mother's favorite. And their father is too. Then Lydia raises one hand to her brow and becomes his mother again. The car is still here, she says. But Nath had known it would be. Lydia can't drive. She doesn't even have a learner's permit yet. Last week, she'd surprised them all by failing the exam, and their father wouldn't even let her sit in the driver's seat without it. Nath stirs his cereal, which has turned to sludge at the bottom of his bowl. The clock in the front hall ticks, then strikes 7:30. No one moves. Are we still going to school today? Hannah asks. Marilyn hesitates. Then she goes to her purse and takes out her keychain with a slow efficiency. You've both missed the bus. Nath, take my car and drop Hannah off on your way. Then, don't worry. We'll find out what's going on. She doesn't look at either of them. Neither looks at her. When the children have gone, she takes a mug from the cupboard, trying to keep her hands still. Long ago, when Lydia was a baby, Marilyn had once left her in the living room, playing on a quilt, and went into the kitchen for a cup of tea. She had been only 11 months old. Marilyn took the kettle off the stove and turned to find Lydia standing in the doorway. She had started and set her hand down on the hot burner. A red spiral welt rose on her palm, and she touched it to her lips and looked at her daughter through watering eyes. Standing there, Lydia was strangely alert, as if she were taking in the kitchen for the first time. Marilyn didn't think about missing those first steps, or how grown up her daughter had become. The thought that flashed through her mind wasn't, how did I miss it, but what else have you been hiding? Nath had pulled up and wobbled and tipped over and toddled right in front of her. But she didn't remember Lydia even beginning to stand. Yet she seemed so steady on her bare feet, tiny fingers just peeking from the ruffled sleeve of her romper. Marilyn often had her back turned, opening the refrigerator or turning over the laundry. Lydia could have begun walking weeks ago, while she was bent over a pot, and she would not have known. She had scooped Lydia up and smoothed her hair and told her how clever she was, how proud her father would be when he came home. But she'd felt as if she'd found a locked door in a familiar room. Lydia, still small enough to cradle, had secrets. Marilyn might feed her and bathe her and coax her legs into pajama pants. But already, parts of her life were curtained off. She kissed Lydia's cheek and pulled her close, trying to warm herself against her daughter's small body. Now, Marilyn sips tea and remembers that surprise. The high school's number is pinned to the corkboard beside the refrigerator, and Marilyn pulls the card down and dials, twisting the cord around her finger while the phone rings.
Middlewood High, the secretary says on the fourth ring. This is Dottie.
She recalls Dottie, a woman built like a sofa cushion, who still wore her fading red hair in a beehive. Good morning, she begins, and falters.
Is my daughter in class this morning?
Dottie makes a polite cluck of impatience.
To whom am I speaking, please?
It takes her a moment to remember her own name.
Marilyn. Marilyn Lee. My daughter is Lydia Lee. 10th grade.
We've just heard Everything I Never Told You by Celeste Ng. Juan Jose Valdez is a National Geographic geographer and National Geographic Maps Director of Editorial and Research. He guides and assists the Map Policy Committee in setting border representations, disputed territories, and naming conventions for National Geographic. He is also responsible for ensuring the accuracy and consistency of the Society's maps and map products. Born in Havana, Cuba, and raised in the U.S., Juan Jose oversaw the development of National Geographic's groundbreaking new map of Cuba, National Geographic's first rendering of the island since 1906. He also was assigned to help lead National Geographic's cultural and educational tours to Cuba. Today we'll speak with Juan Jose on the just-released 10th edition of the National Geographic Atlas of the World, which marks the 100th anniversary of cartography of the prestigious society. Welcome, Juan Jose, and thank you for joining us today on the Book Report.
Thanks for having me, Elaine.
Tell us a bit about the history of cartography at National Geographic.
Well, this coming March, we will be celebrating our centennial, 100 years of cartography at National Geographic. However, if you go back a little bit further, we've been mapping the world since the first issue of the magazine, which was published in October of 1888. We really didn't have a formal cartographic department until 1915, however. So that's a brief history.
Okay. How did you become a cartographer?
Well, I've always had a great interest in maps. When I was a little boy, I was introduced to in geography through going to the airport and watching planes come in and then going home at night and trying to figure out where all these planes were coming from. And one thing led to another, and I was fortunate enough to make cartography a career, and I've been doing such here at National Geographic for just about 40 years now.
Oh, all right. I know this is the new edition, the 10th edition of the National Geographic Atlas of the World. How does this atlas differ from the last one that was issued?
Well, we've added many more reference maps, 9 new reference maps, as a matter of fact, of areas that are currently in the news or of geopolitical significance. So, for instance, England, Scotland, and Wales have their own separate map. The Mediterranean region has its own separate map. We focused in on South Africa, the first time we've done a fairly detailed map of that country. We also have mapped Australia at one consistent scale on 3 separate pages, so that there's much greater detail in that continent. Then we have 20 thematic maps which have focused on themes, basically trends that are taking place on the planet today, whether they be tectonic issues or cultural patterns or economic patterns, they're all there. So we've made what we consider to be a practical resource that will assist the user, family, business to better understand what's going on around the world today.
You know, when you look at the atlas, you'll see that it has a great diversity of subjects, as you said. For example, there are even sections on space and maps of the ocean floor. How many different professionals work on the atlas, and from how many different areas of expertise?
Well, we had 14 cartographers work on this atlas in various areas. However, we did reach out to many, many sources, many agencies to provide us with the latest detailed information into specific topics that we were mapping.
So how many years did it take to create the new atlas?
Well, it didn't take years. It took months, basically 11 months from start to finish. And that sounds awfully fast, but you have to keep in mind that we already had much of this cartographic information stored in our database. It was just a matter of going in and updating the information that we had. The thematic maps at the very beginning of the atlas were a different story. We had to do some redesign, some additional research to bring those plates up to speed. But overall, most of the information was basically existing in our database.
We're speaking with Juan Jose Valdez on the Book Report. You know, you mentioned Scotland. I just visited the country, so I studied the Scottish map extensively. How large does a town or village have to be included on the map?
Well, at the atlas level, we're talking about a populated place with 1,500 people or more.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if it's of importance, historical importance of some or of cultural significance, will show it on the map.
Has climate change affected the atlas from its last version?
Ever so subtly in some areas and dramatic in others. So, for instance, the Aral Sea, due to channeling of rivers and some climatic relations there, is much smaller than it appeared in the 9th edition atlas. But the most significant change was on our Arctic Ocean plate, where the extent of multi-year ice is considerably smaller than it was in the 9th edition atlas.
Well, here's kind of a tough question. In a time when Google Maps are so widely used, what is the future of an atlas?
Well, that's a very good question. The future of the atlas, or an atlas, is that it's a tactile vehicle. You can really take a look at an area on a much larger format than you can on a screen. You can better see the interconnections or geographic interconnections of areas, regions, and countries in an atlas than you would otherwise see on a screen. You're rather limited there. And then there's that whole, like I said, tactile experience of touching, feeling, exploring, something that, from my perspective, is a little bit difficult to do online.
Yes, I would have to agree. I'm just wondering, you know, with such volatility in what used to be the Soviet Union, Greater Russia, and also countries in Africa, I mean, is there an online companion to the Atlas when there's a significant change in borders that you direct people to?
Well, currently we are revising our World Atlas app, which is basically a version of the 10th edition Atlas. And what we plan on doing is just updating the app to current standards. And of course, if there's a earth-shattering event, we will revise the app accordingly as quickly as possible.
And where can people get the Atlas?
The Atlas can be found at shop.nationalgeographic.com, through Amazon, and through local bookstores. The world is an ever-changing place, and to keep this in mind, a map is the greatest of all epic poems. Its lines and colors show the realization of great dreams.
All right. Well spoken. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Elaine. My pleasure.
All righty. Goodbye now.
Bye-bye.
After three acclaimed novels, Gary Steingart turns to a memoir in a candid, witty, deeply poignant account of his life so far. In Little Failure, Steingart shares his American immigrant experience, moving back and forth through time and memory with self-deprecating humor, moving insights, and literary bravado. The result is a resonant story of family and belonging that feels quite intimate. Provocative and hilarious, this is a memoir of an immigrant family coming to America as told by a lifelong misfit. Jonathan Todd Ross performs the book.
At the Strand Book Annex, I stuffed my tote with specimens from the 50% discounted trade paperbacks aisle, sifting through the discarded review copies, looking for someone just like me on the back cover. A young goateed boulevardier, a desperately urban person, obsessed with the Orwells and Dos Passeses, ready for another Spanish Civil War if only those temperamental Spanishers would get around to having one. And if I found such a doppelganger, I would pray that his writing wasn't good, because the publication pie was only so big. Surely these blue-blooded American publishers, those most random of houses, would see right through my overeager immigrant prose and give the ring to some jerk from Brown, his junior year at Oxford or Salamanca giving him all the pale color needed for a marketable Bildungsroman. After handing over $6 to the Strand, I would run back to my office to swallow all 240 pages of the novel in one go, while my Russian co-workers hooted it up next door with their vodka-fueled poetry. I was desperately looking for the sloppy turn of phrase or the MFA cliché that would mark the novel in question inferior to the one gestating in my office computer. Idiotic working title? The Pyramids of Prague. One day after courting gastric disaster by eating two portions of Wall Street Vindaloo, I exploded into the Strand's art and architecture section. My then $29,000 a year salary no match for the handsome price tag on a Rizzoli volume of nudes by Egon Schiele. But it wasn't a melancholic Austrian who would begin to chip away at the alcoholic and doped-up urban gorilla I was steadily becoming. It wouldn't be those handsome Teutonic nudes that would lead me on the path back to the uncomfortable place. The book was called St. Petersburg, Architecture of the Tsars, the Baroque blue hues of the Smolny Convent Cathedral practically jumping off the cover. With its 6 pounds of thick, glossy weight, it was, and still is, a coffee table book. This was in itself a problem. The woman I was in love with at the time, another Oberlin graduate, love who you know, my provincial theory, had already criticized my bookshelves for containing material either too lightweight or too masculine. Whenever she came by my new Brooklyn studio apartment, her pale Midwestern eyes scanning the assembled soldiers of my literary army for a Tess Gallagher or a Jeanette Winterson, I found myself yearning for her taste and, as a corollary, the press of her razor-sharp collarbone against mine. Hopelessly, I arranged my Oberlin texts, such as Tabitha Kanogo's Squatters and the Roots of Mau Mau, next to newly found woman ethnic gems such as Lois Ann Yamanaka's Wild Meat and the Bully Burgers, which I always imagined to be the quintessential Hawaiian coming-of-age story. Someday, I should read it. If I bought Architecture of the Tsars, I would have to hide it from this girl-woman in one of my cupboards behind a scrim of roach motels and bottles of cheap Georgie vodka. Other than failing my parents and being unable to finish the Pyramids of Prague, my main sorrow consisted of my loneliness. My first girlfriend ever, a fellow Oberlin student, an attractive, curly-haired white girl from North Carolina, had gone down south to live with a handsome drummer in his van. I would spend 4 years after graduating college without so much as kissing a girl. Breasts and backsides and caresses and the words, "I love you, Gary," lived on only in abstract memory. Unless I'm telling you otherwise, I am completely in love with everyone around me for the rest of this book.
We've just heard Little Failure by Gary Steingart. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed our trek through some truly thought-provoking and entertaining books. For more titles to keep you turning those pages, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.